Welcome to the netzpolitik.org podcast. My name is Markus Beckedahl, and my guest today is Lawrence Lessig, the founder of Creative Commons. And we have some questions about copyright issues, about net politics to him. And Larry, can you explain us what is Creative Commons?
So Creative Commons is a nonprofit that was founded in 2002 with the purpose of creating free legal tools that people could use to mark their creative work with the freedoms they intended to carry. The reason we thought this was necessary was that the law of copyright, as it was being interpreted, increasingly said that all creative work automatically came stamped with an all rights reserve rule, which technically meant for many of the uses that the internet was enabling, you needed to clear permission to do the most obvious things, copying or changing or sharing creative work. And we believe that many creators who are creating for the internet had a different norm, different set of ethics that they were operating under. They wanted to make their work available. They wanted to participate in the sharing economy of creating and sharing work. So we wanted to give them a simple way to say that, in part to enable that creativity, in part just to show people that the world was not divided between these all rights reserved extremists and people who didn't believe in intellectual property, that there in fact was a range of positions, and some of them were very supportive of sharing, while not supportive of these very strict rules that require lots of lawyers to be involved in the middle of any kind of creative work.
A special question we always do have about Creative Commons is you can choose between non-commercial and commercial licenses. So that's for the start, it's a very good thing. But then there's a question, what means commercial? What means uncommercial? Can you explain it to us what the debate now is about?
Yeah, it's a very hard question because, you know, we begin by taking the internet as we find it. And what I think that means is recognizing there are communities of people who are creating and sharing their creativity, who expect that their creativity will not be exploited commercially, at least without asking permission first. So in Flickr's, there are millions. Last time I looked, it was 15 million images that were licensed under Creative Commons licenses. The vast majority of those, two-thirds of those, are licensed in a non-commercial way, by which the person means, if you're going to take my picture and put it in Time magazine, I want you to contact me and get permission from me and pay me, because that's a commercial use of my work, and I'm just authorizing this non-commercial use. So it's a signal, a way for somebody to say they want to be part of this sharing economy without allowing all their work to be just exploited in any commercial way imaginable. Now, there are a lot of contexts where it's hard to figure out what the line is between commercial and non-commercial. And that's not just because, you know, we haven't been careful enough in defining the terms. It's because the actual practices of communities are different. So what it might mean in the music context is different from what it might mean in the video context. It might be different in the picture context or in the blog context. And so our definition self-consciously tries to build upon the norms of these different communities. So it's we have some guidelines that we're going to be issuing very soon that will set out some pretty clear examples on both sides. So, you know, if you take my picture and you sell it, that's easy commercial use. If you take my song and you file share it in a non-commercial context, that's a non-commercial use. So some pretty clear examples on both extremes, and then guidelines for thinking about the hard, the cases that are hard in the middle. For example, one of the most contested debates is whether people who are reposting blog entries can put advertisement around the repostings. There are some people who think, absolutely, of course, the future of the net is a future supported by advertising, and if non-commercial means you can't be part of that, you won't be part of the net. There are other people who think quite strongly that any usage of advertising turns it into a commercial process. And we're trying to develop norms to help us separate out these two different communities and make it easy for people to signal the part they want to be a part of. But the critical insight that, you know, really guides what we how we think about this is we're not out there to reform how people think about their relationship to their creativity. we're out there to give them tools to help them express it to others in a reliable and simple way. And then once there's a simple way to express it, then people can begin to argue about it. So if an academic put his work up in a way that said, you can share this for non-commercial purposes, for example, an article published in a journal, I would say to that academic, why should it be for non-commercial purposes? Why not just allow the broadest distribution possible? And so the point is, the license now gives me a way to begin to have an argument with somebody about how free the content should be. And you know, this argument, that argument about where freedom, how broadly freedom should extend, is the argument that every community of creativity needs to have, not just the software community.
If I have a band and I release MP3 under non-commercial license, and Sony, for example, wants to get some context with me, but they just found my song in a file sharing peer-to-peer thing, how do they find me?
Yeah, so we've been working on this general problem of how you mark digital objects with licenses. And MP3s, an object which we solved a couple years ago, where if the MP3 is properly marked with a Creative Commons license, that MP3 has two links in it. One is a link to a URL that is the license, so it would be the non-commercial license. And the other is a link back to an authenticating web page that actually authenticates the license. And that web page is set up by the band, for example, releasing the music. So I should be able to go from that MP3 back to some web page to both figure out whether, in fact, this is licensed in the way the person says it's licensed, and also to discover who it is that's licensed again. So ideally, Sony should be able to click through back to that page, see the band that's licensed this, contact the person who indicates the contact information on that web page, and say, we'd like to license this for our CD. So it's very much a part of what we're trying to do to not just define the world between commercial and non-commercial, or at least enable that definition to be real, but also enable crossover, right? So an easy way to get from the non-commercial license back to a place where somebody can talk about commercial rights, if in fact that's what the user wants to do.
You talked about a sharing economy, and Yochai Benkler, for example, talks about the information or networked information economy. What's the new thing on that economy comparable to old economy?
Well, I think the really important point, regardless of the name you use, is to recognize something which, once you see it, is really obvious, and that is there are different economies of creativity. Right? So, you know, the Sony lives in one economy where they pay their artists, people buy their CDs. The idea that you would go out and volunteer for Sony is a crazy thing, not because Sony's a, you know, bad company, but because it's an inappropriate way to deal with a company, the idea that you would volunteer to help Sony. It just doesn't make sense. So people interact with Sony, artists and lawyers and distributors of content and advertisers, in the traditional commercial marketplace. That marketplace produces extraordinarily important value for the world, right? In lots of different contexts, creates products otherwise it couldn't be created, and it's necessary and valuable and needs to be supported. But the critical point that Benkler and others are making obvious is that's not the only productive economy out there. There are also increasingly prevalent in the context of the web communities that are their own economy, that are producing great value. But the norms or the ethics of those communities are different from the norms and the ethic of the commercial economy. So thousands of people spend endless hours making Wikipedia into this fantastic web-based resource. They do it for free. They do the most tedious, insanely boring work for free. And one thing, why they do that is unclear, but one thing that I think is clear is if Jimmy Wales went on to, you know, got the board of Wikipedia to agree they would pay editors of Wikipedia for their edits, I think you'd get fewer edits in Wikipedia, not more. Because people in that community aren't doing it for the money. They're doing it for the love of what they're doing. They want to produce something great, and they do it in a way that, you know, is outside of the commercial marketplace. Now, the point to recognize is that this also produces great value. And rather than being dogmatic and saying, well, we either have to have the commercial economy or the sharing economy, like extreme capitalist or extreme communist or something like that, to recognize both of these economies live together in our social life, and we want both of them, right? There's some places where it's totally appropriate to think about the commercial economy. You know, when I go out and my job during the day, I want to be paid for it. The idea that my university would say, oh, teach because you're part of the sharing economy of knowledge would be ridiculous. No, I'm only going to teach if you pay me. But on the other hand, there are parts of my life where it's totally inappropriate to think about the commercial economy, right? So, you know, I love my wife. I have relations with my wife that are based on sharing. They're not based on money, right? The idea that I would say to my best friend, let's have lunch and I'll pay you $50 if you'll have lunch to me, is a kind of perversion of what the nature of that relationship is. So these two kinds of economies live within our life all the time, and we need rules that encourage and facilitate both of them to exist. Now, I think what's most interesting in the internet economy is increasingly we're seeing businesses that are hybrids between these two. So think about Red Hat as the best example. And Red Hat wants to make a lot of money. They want to be the next Microsoft, at least in the sense of that profitable. But they build their profit on top of a sharing economy. People who for free produce improvements to the GNU Linux operating system in a way that is driven primarily by the desire of people to produce and create and share their creativity, not because they're being paid for it, right? Well, the thing that Red Hat has to do is to figure out how it can exploit, in the best sense of that word, this sharing economy without polluting it, right? Because if it does it in a bad or clumsy way, then people will say, I don't want to contribute to this GNU Linux operating system anymore. Why should I? People are just taking my work and making money off it. I'll go do something else, right? So it has this delicate balance it has to strike to be able to profit but not pollute the sharing economy that it's building off of. Now, that's the most famous example, but as you begin to think of what's important about the net right now, there are many, many, many more examples that really have nothing to do with software anymore. So think about Second Life, this virtual community online, where the programmers of Second Life originally just created a platform where if you become a member of Second Life, you go out there, these empty fields. People spent endless amounts of time building things for this platform. For free, they're creating value in this platform. And that value makes Second Life more valuable for other people. So Second Life is, again, trying to create this economy where people will, for free, create objects which make their platform more valuable so they, in turn, can sell more memberships to that platform. Think about, MySpace. These kids come on and take this coding space and they build value in it, drawing more people to it in a way that makes the company ultimately very, very valuable. Now, MySpace, the company, is trying to profit off of this, but again, it can't profit in a way that makes it so the kids say, oh, this is sharecropping. I'm not going to go put my work in there and get nothing in return. So they again have to strike this balance between the commercial and the sharing economy. In my view is we really need to figure out what makes this sharing economy work. And that comes, again, from not being dogmatic and insisting that there's only one way of looking at the world, but instead being much more Catholic in our willingness to incorporate different perspectives and learn from them. And because it's an empirical question right now, but if we get it right, it could produce great opportunities for value and wealth in the traditional way of money, but also in the social way of opening up opportunities for interaction and community that before the internet had been shut down by the traditional way in which the market and real space functions.
You gave us some examples of business models, but except maybe Second Life, it sounded more like a hybrid models. What can real sharing economy business models be, or how will they look like?
Well, in my way of defining the world, if it's a business model, meaning a model someone has for making money, it is by definition hybrid. Okay, so let's be clear about some examples. iTunes is not a hybrid economy. iTunes is a platform for a traditional commercial economy. The idea you would volunteer for Apple in iTunes is silly, right? They're just trying to sell product or services. They're doing it very well. They're profiting because of that, and good for them, right? But if what the company is trying to do is to profit by leveraging a community, you know, they could be doing that in a very thin way. For example, getting people to provide ratings of products, which then makes it easier for people to figure out how to buy products. That's what Amazon does. Or in a very thick way, where what they're trying to do is to get people to build communities around content, like Flickr, and rate other people's content in a way that makes it easier to identify. In that case, Flickr, that's very much a hybrid economy, because they want to make money, but they want to encourage a community. Now, on the other extreme, you can have sharing economies that are just about the sharing economy. Nobody's trying to make money out of it, right? And Wikipedia is the best example of that right now. I mean, Wikipedia is the constitution that really limits its ability to make money out of itself, right? It is a community. And if all of a sudden they started putting ads up, there would be a revolt of people, because it is just about the community right now. Now, of course, the license permits people to take that content and do whatever they want with it. But in some sense, as long as they obey the share-alike like rules, but in some sense, the community is really just trying to build a community there. Now, I think that there's a place for all three of these different economies, right? There'll be always a place for the pure commercial. There should always be a place for the pure sharing. But there's an increasingly important place, this thing that's new here, for the hybrid.
Let's come to some threats for innovation and creativity. What's wrong with copy protection? The answer of old economy to the freedoms of the new net?
Yeah, well, this is... So understanding the problems of copy protection really requires understanding these different economies, right? So, you know, look at what people are doing on the net. One thing they're doing is they're just consuming culture, and there are lots of really effective technologies to help them consume it better. So iTunes, again, is the best example. Subscribe to iTunes, download television, watch it on your computer or watch it on your iPod. It's a more efficient way to get access to television than television, right? I mean, I go into hotel rooms now and I think, why is there that stupid thing on the wall called a television anymore? I mean, who would waste their time actually clicking through the 150 channels to see if there's something you want to watch? Of course there's not going to be anything you want to watch. The idea that you would randomly be in the hotel room at a time when you would be watching something that just came on is just crazy. Of course, the more obvious way, the more efficient way to get access to culture that I just want to consume is to have it on my machine or be able to download it at any time I want and watch it, right? So that kind of culture, which I call read-only culture, the internet is enabling in a really powerful way. But then there's another kind of culture the internet's also enabling, what we could call read-write, where the objective is not just to get culture that you consume, but to get culture that you consume and you have the right to do things with and share that with others. So again, Wikipedia does this, Flickr does this, video sharing sites do this. These are all companies that are in the business of not just giving people access to culture, but giving them access to culture that they can do something with and share with others. Well, this is where DRM becomes so problematic, because whereas DRM perfectly supports the read-only internet vision of what it's trying to do, right? So find ways to wrap the content, protect it perfectly so that I can really control exactly how much you buy and that you don't try to use it beyond what you buy. Those same tools lock out the opportunity for the read-write internet to occur. Because if I download this, you know, this movie from Rever and I'm not able to remix it or cut it up or use it in another movie I'm trying to make, then because DRM blocks me, then the read-write internet is undermined in order to protect the read-only internet, right? So my point is there's an ecology here that we should be supporting that has both of these activities, the read-only and the read-write. And if we choose a certain tool to support the read-only, we will kill off the opportunity for the read-write. So if you choose DRM as the tool to protect the read-only economy, then you're choosing a tool that will kill off the ecology of the read-write economy. And so that's why I think we need to think about other ways to protect the read-only internet that don't have the, you know, doesn't have the consequence of wiping out the read-write internet, right? This is a kind of familiar insight in the context of environmentalism, right? My colleague, board member of Creative Commons, Jamie Boyle, 10 years ago, started writing about it in this way. You know, you don't use DDT to kill a gnat, not because it's not effective at killing gnats. It is. It kills gnats quite effectively. But because the consequence of using DDT to kill a gnat is that it also kills off a wide range of wildlife that you don't want to be killing off, you know, the bald eagle or other examples like that. So you need to pick your weapon in light of the consequences of the weapon, and you need to think about the widest range of the environment when you start picking that weapon. And that's the problem. That's one of the problems with DRM, that it's picking the read-only culture, forgetting the read-write culture, just at the time that technology is encouraging the read-write culture to flourish in a way it hasn't in 110 years.
The environmental movement is a nice example. 40 years ago, there were some people warning about threats to the environment and stuff like that. Now there's a huge movement of millions and millions of people organized in big organizations like Greenpeace and other ones. What can we learn from the environmental movement, and what are our pictures comparing to pictures like Chernobyl or dead ropes or other stuff? What helped people to understand that environmentalism is an important issue?
Well, one of the most important things about environmentalism was that it made everybody recognize how they were part of the story, right? So it wasn't a movement that tried to say there are good people and bad people and we ought to, you know, get rid of the bad people and celebrate the good people. It wasn't just a bunch of tree huggers out there. The environmental movement succeeded when it got businesses to recognize that they had an interest in the environment too. And it got conservatives to realize that there was a certain principle of environmentalism that, you know, expressed certain conservative values. So in the environmentalism context, you know, one of the reasons why you oppose pollution, you know, translated into the language of pure economics, is the polluter is imposing a cost on society which he hasn't paid for. And that's inefficient. It's just inefficient, right? It's not morally good or bad. You can say it's just inefficient. And once you begin to see it like that, then you can bring together different political perspectives advancing this common goal of regulation to preserve the environment. That's the same thing that has to happen in the context of what I think was the free culture movement. People have to recognize there's an environmentalism here. So we've got to protect the environment of read-only and read-write. They have to be able to coexist. And we do that by getting people to recognize that this is not just a simple political issue of left versus right. But instead, there are people on the left and the right who should be able to agree about the general framework and begin to work out how we implement it. I think the equivalence to the pictures of Chernobyl, is the picture of the couch potato, right? There's a wonderful Apple ad, the 1984 ad when they were launching their Macintosh, which has this image of all these people, you know, evoked from the book 1984, sitting before a big telescreen, and they're sitting there as these clones all just watching. And that's the image of, you know, Chernobyl for us, for a culture. Like the idea of these couch potatoes just consuming what's fed to them, not having any ability to interact or to produce or create in response, is the equivalent of a dead culture, right? And we need those images to kind of drive us to how we could build a more participatory culture in response.
Another question we always have is, there's also the project Science Commons. In Germany or in Europe, it isn't popular at this time. What is the idea behind Science Commons comparable to Creative Commons?
Well, so I describe Creative Commons as saying we wanted to provide simple tools to enable authors to mark their content with the freedoms they intended to carry. That's a particular implementation of a more general idea. The more general idea is, how can we hack the legal system to allow people to do what they want to do, but which right now the legal system would inhibit them from doing, right? And if you take the array of all those ways we could hack the legal system, we've picked the low-hanging fruit first, okay? Well, Science Commons is trying to do that in the context of science. So the first place that they did it, and it is important internationally, is in the context of open access publishing. So some of the most important open access journals or projects use Creative Commons licenses to mark their published works in a way that makes them universally accessible without barriers of wealth or access. So the Public Library of Science is the best example of that, but there are many more that are trying to make it so people, regardless of their origin of national, their national origin or their wealth, can get access to scientific knowledge freely. But beyond that obvious extension from Creative Commons, the Science Commons Project is working on other areas where the default legal regime inhibits the kind of research and development that people otherwise would think they want to do. So, for example, in the context of work around materials and transfer, materials transfer projects, here too there are simple ways in which we could hack the legal system to facilitate broader transfer of materials, consistent with what the scientists want, but inconsistent with how the default of copyright law or patent law functions. And so we're exploring in a lot of different contexts ways in which we could just make the system function better, more consistent with what the scientist wants, not just by copyright licenses, but by other legal devices that we could deploy that would advance the objective of researches in the context of science.
We will see it. When will it come to Europe?
Well, the Science Commons, I don't know whether it will ever be internationalized in the way Creative Commons is internationalized. But I do think that we will have internationalized projects. So we've been talking in Germany with different science organizations that have projects they'd like to advance which fit this general model. How can you hack the legal system to make it function better for science? And we're exploring developing those projects in different places around the world. But it's not a project that makes sense to try to think of, 150 different jurisdictions that are implementing it. It's a common set of objectives we're trying to achieve internationally, and let's figure out as many places in which we can advance that.
And Germany, you have to choose as a musician if you want to be member of the levy system GEMA or if you want to use Creative Commons. It's because the GEMA isn't, they don't really like Creative Commons in the moment. They say, okay, for our levy system, the licenses are not comparable because we have the composer, we have the author, we have the singer and interpreter. What's your answer to them?
Well, that statement isn't true. Systems are perfectly comparable. In the United States, we have the same structure of rights. What's different is that in the United States, the collecting rights societies are not exclusive. And in many places in Europe, they're exclusive. So you have to make a choice as an artist, whether to be part of the collecting rights society or not. Now, I think the general problem here is that we've not yet come to a stage where the collecting rights societies admit something which I think everybody, when they think about it, must admit. And that is that there are places where people use culture, music, that should not be subject to the regulation of the law. Right? It should be free of the regulation of the law. My favorite example of this is a testimony that John Philip Sousa gave in 1906 before the United States Congress, where he was criticizing the talking machines and how the talking machines are going to destroy artistic development of music. And he romanticizes this idea of the young people together singing the songs of the day or the old songs. That's what he grew up with, like young people getting together on an afternoon or an evening and just singing songs. Now, in that testimony, he was asked by a member of Congress, well, should they pay for that? Because Sousa was testifying in support of strengthening intellectual property. And he was outraged at the question. Of course they shouldn't pay for that. I mean, this is just, use of culture by individuals that, is in some sense free of the regulation of copyright law. And he's emphasizing a point that I think it's easy for us to forget. It is important that there be a use of culture free of the regulation of copyright law. And the job of copyright law is to draw the balance between the appropriate places for regulation and the appropriate places for freedom. Right? So, in principle, the GEMA could put devices in everybody's shower and record what songs you sing in the shower in the morning and charge you for that. Or, in principle, we could be taxing every single context in which music might be performed in order to guarantee that we're collecting revenues every time music is actually invoked. But I think a more traditional view is to recognize there are places where the law of copyright is appropriate and places where it's not. And what we have to do in the context of the internet is try to find ways to draw that line, to distinguish between places it's appropriate and places that it's not. Now, Creative Commons is firmly of the view that it's that we ought to have a free place and we ought to have a regulated place. Right? We ought to have a place where people's use is free of the regulation of copyright law in the effective sense, and a place where it's not free of the regulation of copyright law. And we use devices like the non-commercial commercial distinction or the share alike condition to draw that line. Right? So in the non-commercial space, we're saying, should be able to freely share this. Don't worry about, you know, paying people. Just obey the non-commercial restrictions, you'll be fine. But if you want to begin to perform this publicly or you want to begin to sell this, then that's a commercial use and you have to obey by the commercial rights. So we believe in these two economies living together. And I think, unfortunately, many collecting rights societies believe there should be only one. I mean, I once was at a conference where this woman was talking about the emerging permission society. I use that term as a way to ridicule what's happening, but she was celebrating it. She was talking about a world where every single use of culture would be taxed. We would have devices to figure out every time you hummed or every time you sang, and then you would be paying for that right to do that. And in my view, that's totalitarian, right? There ought to be limits to regulation of culture. And we need to recognize it. And I think more collecting rights societies need to begin to talk about where they think the limit is. Because the logic of their position is, every time culture is invoked, somebody ought to be paid. And if somebody has to be paid, then we have to be monitoring and policing every time culture is invoked. And I think the perpetual spying of the devices necessary to monitor and police every time culture is invoked is wildly more burdensome and costly to society than just dividing between those places where it's appropriate to be regulating and those places that ought to be free. Now, I think there's a long conversation to have with the collecting rights societies, because I think ultimately they will be in the position that I think we already are in. And we'll be talking in common about, well, what is the line? Where is the appropriate line? Is it when 20 kids get together on a MySpace page? Should somebody have to be paying for that music? I think we all agree if you put a song up on the web to sell for people to download, yeah, of course you ought to be paying for that. But it's on the other side that I think we need to have a richer conversation. And those who would simplify the story and just say it's either free for everybody, for all contexts in all ways, or people who say you have to be paid for every single use, both of those simplifiers are making a fundamental mistake.
Another question is, we have lots of talks to non-governmental organizations in using Creative Commons. And to my surprise, NGOs, they think more about control of their contents and companies. Do you have models how it can work, or do you have examples in using CC license by NGOs, or what do you would say to them?
Well, I think that everybody, NGOs and commercial entities and governments, need to rethink the ethics of their behavior in light of the emergence of the net. NGOs are not naturally better people, than people building commercial enterprises. I mean, the people I know building commercial enterprises are some of the most decent and ethical people I know, right? So I don't think there's any natural difference. Like, you have the greedy people in commerce and the good people in NGOs. And often NGOs think that their only resource, their only asset, are these IP things that they control to profit. So museums, I think, are the best example of this. I think it's outrageous the way museums force scholars, for example, to pay ridiculous prices, maybe $5,000, to get a digital image of a public domain picture that they're holding in their museum to publish in a book that will sell no more than 500 copies or 1,000 copies. Yet they do this because they think this is a good way to raise money to run the museum. And my response to that is you need to find better ways to raise money to run the museum. Because the idea of you blocking access to this public domain work is just not a good way to raise money to support a museum. I've been having this exchange in email with a guy who works for the American Red Cross. And the American Red Cross, too, has this extremely restrictive view about information about how to deal with emergencies or to deal with health issues, right? They have these reports or these studies that they have that they've commissioned, but they exercise very strict rights over giving access to it. And, you know, and I've suggested, he said to the American Red Cross, where is it in your business model that you would block the ability of other people to save people too, right? Why is that part of what you're trying to do, to make it harder for others to save other people? You know, and I think if you begin to ask these questions of NGOs, they begin to have to think, well, really, what is our interest here? Like, why would we block anybody's ability to get a free copy of our report about how to deal with malaria in the developing world, right? Well, what interest do we have to block the ability of others to deal with malaria in a developing world? And I think as people ask these questions in lots of contexts, you're going to see a different balance that gets struck, because as they honestly evaluate what's consistent with our values, the values will force people in different contexts to become more open than they are right now. Governments are the most obvious, NGOs the second most obvious. And, you know, maybe ironically, it's businesses, commercial entities, that are actually being the most responsive to this, because they have a commercial interest in getting it right, and their commercial interest forces them to change their behaviors more quickly often than what happens in the NGO context.
I will take the questions to them. One of the last questions, you are into the debate of net neutrality in the United States. In Germany or Europe, we have a bit this discussion, but not so big as in the United States. What's the matter on net neutrality, and why is it in danger?
It's a hard question to answer briefly, because there's a lot of history. But the shortest version of an answer, I think, goes something like this. The internet gets born in the United States in a context of relatively heavy regulation, in the sense that most people use the telephones to connect to the internet, the first part of the internet. And the telephone system is regulated by the government so that the telephone companies are not permitted to discriminate against people using their telephone to fake a computer out and dial up a modem and connect over the telephone wires. They're not able to discriminate against those people in favor of people who use a telephone just to talk. The government says you have to treat these uses neutrally, the same, and that forced regulation creates the opportunity for the internet to get layered on top of a telephone network. I mean, not all parts of it, obviously. The trunk, the broadband, the backbone is laid independently of the telephone wires, but people's last mile ability to connect to the internet is enabled because they can call up on the telephone. Now, ironically, in many parts of Europe, at the same time that this freedom is guaranteed by regulation in the United States, doesn't exist in many parts of Europe. In many parts of Europe, for much of the 1990s, it's a crime to use your telephone to connect to a computer, right? Because they want to be able to charge different prices for that and be able to discriminate and control that application so that the telephone companies can profit off of it. But the United States sets the lead by requiring this neutrality, and that invites the growth of the internet and the explosion of innovation on the internet. Well, an obsession with a kind of deregulation has taken over in the United States for at least the last 8 years. And over that period of time, in the broadband sector, there's been more and more deregulation of broadband, by which that means that the providers of that infrastructure no longer are required to behave neutrally with respect to people who want to use or get access to that infrastructure. So initially, cable broadband is free of any regulation and how people get access to or use broadband across cable. And since since August 5th, 2005, DSL has now been set free of any regulation. So broadband in the United States, there's some technical transition because of mergers, but effectively broadband in the United States since August 5th, 2005 has been free of any regulation for neutrality. So what that means is the providers of broadband, which are an increasingly small set of companies, are now free to pick and choose the content that they'll allow to flow in the broadband network. And they will pick and choose based on what makes them the most money. So they'll say to companies that want to provide video, okay, you want your video to come across in a high quality way, you have to pay a certain video tax. Now that's not a problem for companies like Google, but it will be a problem for companies like Blip TV or, you know, last year, YouTube, right? Companies that are competing with the established companies, they will be it will be harder for them to be able to pay these taxes imposed on access to the internet relative to the existing successful companies. So as these broadband providers layer these burdens of tax on the network, it will slow down innovation and development for the network because it will benefit the established over the new. And so what net neutrality regulation basically tries to do is to layer a relatively thin rule on top of the internet that basically tries to drive broadband providers out of business models that are focused on profiting from scarcity into business models that are focused on improving the access and quality of the internet for everybody. Because again, think about the incentives a broadband provider has in a world where he's allowed to pick and choose the content that comes across the network. So let's say you say, okay, we're going to charge a special price for video. And that price is a price that you have to pay in order to get high quality video across our network. Well, as the provider, you have a couple incentives. You want to make sure that you continue to, people continue to have an incentive to pay you a special price. The only way they have a special incentive to pay you a special price is if the ordinary internet is no good for sending video across, right? The ordinary internet becomes really good for sending video across, why would you pay for the premium? Right? So in that context, the provider has a perverse incentive to actually keep the ordinary internet bad in order to make the premium internet worth it. Right? And so you no longer have an incentive to build the fastest network you can. You have an incentive to keep the network, the public internet, bad so that the private internet becomes valuable. Well, that's exactly the kind of business model or incentive we don't want the providers of the internet to have, because it slows the incentive to build really fast internet. Now, paradoxically, Europe embraced a regulatory strategy, which initially the United States had in the 1996 Telecom Act, that has forced much better broadband competition in Europe than in the United States. And so broadband is cheaper and faster in Europe than it is in the United States, especially in Asia. And that, I think, is partly a response to this regulatory strategy. So you don't need network neutrality regulation in Europe, because you actually have more substantive regulations achieving the same end in Europe. So Europe's not talking about network neutrality, because you've got other regulations doing basically the same thing. It's an important issue in the United States, because we have no regulations governing broadband provision. And that means you have a real incentive for broadband companies to play games with how they develop the internet, contrary to the objective of economic growth overall.
Last question. It's a question or more statement to German politicians. You are now here for 1 year in Berlin. And the German Bundestag is now talking about reforming the European Copyright Directive reform. So they do a second try to establish a EUCD, which mostly based on DMCA. And if you would have the chance to talk to German politicians, what would you say to them about thinking about copyright politics?
Well, I think the most important thing for politicians around the world is to think practically about copyright rather than religiously. There's a kind of attitude around intellectual property, which I think of as the religious attitude, that thinks about intellectual property as an end in itself, as something we should perfect or protect regardless of its consequences for creativity or economic development. You know, it's as if you were you had a project to promote the production of hammers, never asking the question, what are we using hammers for? Right? What is the objective of hammers? And that's the question we need to ask with intellectual property. It is a tool that we, that societies produce in order to create incentives for people to produce creative, great creative work. And the test for whether the tool is working is whether it's actually creating more incentives or whether it's creating more burdens on the creative process. And there are many contexts in which intellectual property right now is producing more harm than good, producing more burdens on the opportunity for people to produce or create or spread creativity than it's producing incentives. I mean, the simplest example is the practice of governments to extend the term of copyrights. Now, you know, we can have an argument about whether it ever makes sense to extend the term of copyrights. I don't think it ever makes sense to extend the term of an existing copyright, because the whole purpose of copyright is to create an incentive to produce. And the one thing we know about works that have already been produced is you can't do anything to change the incentives to produce them. They've already been produced. No matter what we do, George Gershwin will not produce anything more. Elvis Presley will not produce anything more. But put that debate aside for a second. The biggest mistake the governments have been making is they extend the term of copyright indiscriminately. So they say, we're going to change the term from 50 years to 70 years. For example, in Europe, in Britain right now, there's a debate around recordings. Should we extend it from 50 years to 95 years? They want to extend it indiscriminately, not asking the question whether particular recordings that are valuable, like the work of Elvis Presley or the Beatles, should be extended. Instead, they ask the question, should we just extend the term indiscriminately? Well, when you extend the term indiscriminately, even though maybe 2% of that work has a continuing commercial value, 98% of it has no continuing commercial value. So you extend these rights without there being any meaningful opportunity for people to clear the rights, because we don't even know who the owners of the rights are. So we can't use this work because of the legal burdens imposed upon it. And those legal burdens are not creating any new incentives. They're just taxing creative opportunities without producing any incentive on the other side. Now, if you focused on this question in a purely instrumental way and just asked, is this change in copyright law going to produce more good than harm? You would never adopt that change, because it's clearly not. But when you approach it from a religious perspective, should we be protecting intellectual property? Then you never ask the question about the harm, because you just care about the idea of intellectual property. And that really ideological perspective, I think, is producing lots of harm in the context of the internet. Because the internet is creating all sorts of new ways to create and produce and share creativity that were never imagined by the framers of copyright laws from the 19th and 20th century. And unless we think critically about how these laws are inhibiting channels for creativity, the law will, you know, will kill off many of the opportunities before they even get a chance to take off. So the single important message, I think, is to think pragmatically, critically about how intellectual property law is functioning, and not as an ideologue or not as a religious fanatic who has a very simple conception of intellectual property separated from consequences. There's one story that I heard once from a German experience that I think captures the whole point. There was a German professor testifying in some hearing of in the German parliamentary context. And a member asked the question, well, what would the consequence of this change in intellectual property be for economic growth? And the German law professor said, consequences are not my concern. My concern is the idea of intellectual property. It's that response that I think is fundamentally mistaken. Never should someone promoting regulation in this space be allowed to say, consequences are not your concern. The only concern we should have is the consequence of this regulation on the incentives for people to create and spread knowledge. And that is the single determinant of whether things, intellectual property should be extended or not. If we adopt that single rule, I think we'd have of course, intellectual property regulation, but it would be radically different from the kind of intellectual property regulation we have right now.
Okay, famous last question. Do you mind using a share-alike license for releasing this interview?
I don't mind using it. I would prefer a simple attribution license, but that's your freedom to leave it, release it as you wish.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.